SIS 604, Masterworks of International Relations. This is lecture number 5, a lecture on Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Before we actually get started talking about Rousseau, I want to make a comment about Hobbes and Locke, who we've just been considering recently. Because even though Hobbes and Locke are obviously very important figures within the history of political thought, sometimes the question is asked, well, what exactly does this have to do with international relations proper? And the thing that's really interesting is, with these two guys, I think, is that the way that they've come into IR is very odd, because people don't tend to import their theories directly. Instead, IR theorists in the 20th century have tended to take particular pieces from Hobbes and Locke and have kind of imported them into their ways of thinking about the international system. And in particular, what they took was the description of the state of nature. The description of the state of nature in Locke, the description of the state of nature in Hobbes, these show up under slightly different names in contemporary IR theory. For instance, international relations realists, quote-unquote, tend to think of life in the international system as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, short, everybody basically on guard against one another at all times. In that sense, what they have done is they take Hobbes' understanding of the state of nature, detach it from Hobbes' actual prescriptions for life in the state of nature, which, as we have discussed, Hobbes' actual prescription is get out of the state of nature as fast as you can. Any kind of governmental structure is preferable to getting out of the state of nature. But IR realists tend to instead take that particular account of relations between units and have said that, no, this is in fact just the way that things are in the international realm. And so that's the kind of reading of Hobbes that we tend to get in IR, the discipline. The reading of Locke is similarly narrow and similarly misleading if one takes the text as a whole. What has happened instead is that IR scholars took Locke's understanding of the state of nature and have applied that to the international system to produce what is sometimes called either liberalism or neoliberalism, or sometimes you'll hear it referred to as neoliberal institutionalism, the idea that autonomous units without a superior temporal power could actually negotiate and create things that were rationally binding because they fulfilled each other's interests. And while that bears a family resemblance to Locke's account of things, the same way that the notion of states balancing and anarchy bears a family resemblance to Hobbes' account of things, I think it should be pretty clear that these descriptions have been ripped entirely out of context, and that the way that these theorists have passed into the discipline of international relations is somewhat impoverished, and a lot of their actual insights about the way that human beings interact and about the nature of just authority have not really been pushed to the extent that they could within the discipline as a whole. Now, in particular, something that is very odd is that what IR theorists have grabbed onto is the state of nature out of both Hobbes and Locke. And one of the reasons this is very odd is because the state of nature is a very notoriously problematic part of any of these social contract thinkers. The status of the state of nature is actually very unclear within liberal thought. What exactly is being referred to? What is a state of nature? What kind of argument is this that depends on this thing called a state of nature? The state of nature is an imaginative construct, and both Hobbes and Locke, and to some extent Rousseau, will say this, right? The state of nature is an extrapolation, it's a rational extrapolation based on observation. So it's something we've imagined in order to help us figure out what the appropriate and just way of dealing with things are. But even though both Hobbes and Locke tend to say that it is an imaginative construct, they give empirical examples. They give suggestions about when they've seen it, when they've seen things like it. Both of them refer to the savages in America as being an example of people that still inhabit the state of nature. So there's something kind of odd here. If it was an imaginative construct, why do you need to keep giving empirical examples? If you need to give empirical examples, why continue to insist that this is just a rational extrapolation? Something very strange about the status of this state of nature concept. All that, of course, gets strained completely out when IR theorists get a hold of it. But I think it's something we have to really ponder a little bit, because it's so important to these liberal social contract arguments. Because even though the status of the state of nature is unclear in liberal thought, the function is absolutely clear. Right? Why do we need a state of nature in Hobbes's argument or in Locke's argument, or as we'll see in Rousseau's argument. What is the function of the state of nature? Well, the account of the state of nature is important because it guarantees that the social arrangements that are erected to get us out of it, or get us beyond it or past it, are non-arbitrary and important and valuable and, in a sense, rational necessities to get us away from this particular state of nature which we would otherwise be inhabiting. If one doesn't buy Hobbes' account of how people function in the absence of social authority, how people function in the absence of a state, in the absence of a Leviathan, then one might not be quite as compelled to accept certain kinds of sovereigns, certain kinds of governmental domination. If one doesn't buy Locke's account of people getting together and making rational bargains even in the absence of a sovereign, then one might not be quite so sanguine about the idea of limited government, and vice versa. Right? It's a lot wrapped up with the validity or accuracy of the account of the state of nature that is given. And so for that reason, it's tremendously important. The status question doesn't go away when we read these things. And so it's something we've really got to keep in mind, and do something that the professionals in IR have largely tended not to do, which is to go back and read and see what's actually going on with these particular things. Because it's important. It's important. The whole argument rests on you buying that account of the state of nature. And if you buy it, you may be persuaded by the rest of the argument. If you don't buy it, you're likely not going to be. Further ambiguities about the state of nature. State of nature represents the past, right? It represents things that used to exist, because contemporary arrangements are supposed to be an improvement, to represent some sort of progress from the state of nature to civilize society or something along those lines. So state of nature is not now, but then. But at the same time, the state of nature also represents perfect freedom. There are no social constraints. In Hobbes' terms, the state of nature is the realm of perfect liberty. In Locke's terms, you have a right to everything, and everyone is the executor of the law of nature in the state of nature. Those things are things that we give up to enter society. So there's this ambiguous character of the state of nature. It's in the past, it's something we've progressed beyond, but there's still elements of it that sort of seem freer than what we presently have. This kind of weighing of freedom versus progress, whether the trade-off is worthwhile, whether to be civilized it's worth giving up certain amounts of natural liberty, this is a central dilemma in liberal thinking, right? This has been animating debates between liberals about governmental authority for generations. Right? So this is not a new issue in that sense. And this is something that, again, cuts right to the heart of this notion of the value of the state of nature, which is why it's so important that we linger on that question as we read through these things. And this gets particularly interesting when we start talking about Jean-Jacques Rousseau, pictured here. Because for Rousseau, inequality, this is not in the social contract which we read, but in the discourse on inequality, which I sort of recommended people read if they have, you know, oodles of time. Rousseau's point in the discourse on inequality is that inequality is not natural. It's a social product. It's been produced. There's no natural necessity that makes people unequal to each other. The structure of his argument is very interesting. He starts off with the state of nature, as these folks all did, and argues that the state of nature is a state of perfect freedom. Everybody is perfectly equal in the state of nature. It is also, a little contrast here between him and Hobbes in particular, peaceful. And it's peaceful because of natural sympathy. People are naturally sympathetic to one another, according to Rousseau in the Discourse on Inequality, which is part of the reason why you know there can't be any inequality in the state of nature, that it couldn't be natural, because people do have this natural sympathy. Something about coming into society shuts off those natural sympathies, closes them down, drives us apart from one another. So in that sense, social life becomes a prison. Social life imprisons man. It takes human beings away from their natural state of full liberty and rights and puts them into the constraints and shackles of a civilization. But, Rousseau says, it's not all bad. It's not all bad, because living in society also allows you to cultivate higher virtues to become a more perfect moral being, which you can't be in the state of nature because you're just acting on instinct all the time. So there is progress associated with moving into society and out of the state of nature, but it is not a clear-cut improvement. There's also a degeneration of humanity that happens as humanity becomes civilized. And Rousseau is more conscious of that trade-off than some of the earlier folks have been. For Hobbes, there's no question, right? State of nature, bad, get out. For Locke, state of nature, well, maybe it's not necessarily evil, but you know, you wouldn't want to live there for very long, and it would be much better if you did things a little more rationally over here. For Rousseau, kind of a touchy question. Good thing, bad thing, not entirely sure, and he's very clear in Discourse on Inequality about both the benefits and the costs of having the race having civilized itself, as it were. So how does this actually play into IR? Because unlike Hobbes and Locke, people do not generally rip Rousseau's beneficent state of nature out of context to apply it to the international system. Not a lot of people arguing that states have natural sympathy with one another, or that they are somehow all getting along before civilization comes along and, like, you know, disciplines them into their separate boxes or something. But if they did, what might it look like if people were actually to pull Rousseau's state of nature and try to apply it to the international system? Well, the first thing you'd get is that social relations, especially dominance relations, are not natural. They're not guaranteed by natural necessity. Instead, social relations are the product of various kinds of social decisions and social actions. So the fact that we have dominant powers and weaker powers is something that would have to be explained in terms of their histories of social interaction. And if you pulled Rousseau's state of nature out, then you would realize, or one might say, that hierarchical relationships that exist actually depend on certain kind of tacit social consensus. Because Rousseau's account of... Rousseau. Rousseau's account of inequality in the Discourse on Inequality is that we have unequal social relations now largely because we've convinced ourselves that those social relations are logical, and him, by offering an argument to say that they're not, is hoping, therefore, to change them. There's no necessary reason why we need to consent to these sorts of things. So if you see relationships of dominance, Rousseau would say, and a hypothetical Rousseauian international relations theorist would say, then you have to look for tacit consent. You have to look for ways that the powerful buy off the less powerful. You have to look for ways that the states on the bottom kind of buy a vision that legitimates the rule of those on top. In fact, you have to look more broadly at the whole issue of public legitimation and how it is that reasons that sound good are put into circulation, therefore making certain orders appear to be natural and inevitable and sustainable when they really may not be, because there isn't anything natural about them. They're just a social construct. If IR theorists were to do this, they would most probably be IR constructivists, who you may have run into in other classes, people who believe that social actions constitute norms and identities, and that, not interests and not the inevitable dangers of life under anarchy, is what directly governs and shapes the actions of individual states and individual leaders. So if people were to pull out Rousseau's state of nature, they might be constructivists, at least of the liberal variety. There are sort of two flavors of international relations constructivism. There's the more cynical kind that points out that, like, genocide and ethnic cleansing are norms too. And then there's the more liberal side, which says, well, norms, you know, those are nice things like universal human rights and open markets and the integrity of the person and all those kinds of things. So there's a little, you know, there's a little internal constructivist discussion going on here, but both styles of constructivism certainly agree that social relations have to be accounted for in terms of social practices that sustain them. And so on that score, if somebody was to pull out the IR state of nature, or pull the state of nature out of Rousseau and apply it to IR, they might end up being constructivists. So, though, footnote, most constructivists don't do this. In fact, most moderns don't do this, because we've largely given up the state of nature for reasons that I think would be interesting to explore at some point later on during this course. Why this notion of a state of nature as the place to begin theorizing, which used to be so prominent, right, during the 17th and 18th centuries, has basically disappeared. Nobody starts with a state of nature anymore. Even people who do, or start with something like it, something like John Rawls, for instance, who starts with what he calls the veil of ignorance. Right? Individuals are standing behind this veil, and they go to choose a social order. And the question is, if you didn't know where in that social order you were going to be placed, what kind of social order would you choose? This is an argument that Rawls uses to delegitimate the idea of a situation or a system based on hierarchies, on dominance, on you know, castes or class demarcations, because Rawls argues you can't possibly say those are just, because the only reason people choose those is because they benefit from them. Whereas if they didn't know where they were going to be, everybody would choose a structure that was a little more egalitarian, because they wouldn't know where they would actually end up. Even an exercise like that isn't really a state of nature theory, because it doesn't posit the same kind of argumentative structure as we get with a state of nature in Hobbes and Locke, and then a little bit in Rousseau as well. So even that kind of exercise doesn't do it. So we might ask ourselves, where did that go? Where did the state of nature go as a way of thinking about politics, as a way of thinking about social order, as a way of thinking about international politics in particular? Huh. Interesting question. Another thing I need to mention when we start talking about Rousseau is that Rousseau often gets blamed for the French Revolution. Right? He gets tarred and feathered as the guy who made the French Revolution possible, because he said these things and people believed him and they said, hey, we can rise up and overthrow the king, and in fact, let's kill him. So people tend to blame this on Rousseau a lot. In particular, the fact that Rousseau introduces this notion of the people as a whole being sovereign, not individuals, not the government, but the people as a whole, popular sovereignty, which is something that Rousseau really theorizes and thematizes in a much more elaborate way than anybody had before him. People say, hey, look, French revolutionary mobs took that to heart. The other thing that people tend to find in Rousseau as a direct cause of the French Revolution is this idea of the general will, and in particular, Rousseau's statements that the general will cannot be opposed, the general will can never be wrong. And people, particularly those who are not very happy with liberalism per se, will often say that Rousseau's greatest fault, is saying that the general will can't be opposed because that gives license to people who say they represent the general will to go in and do things like, oh, institute the terror, which was the way that one of the chapters of the French Revolution tried to govern the country, by killing off lots of people who it thought of as its enemies and such. So they say the general will, the idea that the general will cannot be opposed, leads you to the terror of the French Revolution, and therefore leads you directly down a slippery slope to fascism. So Rousseau is where everything got off track for some generally socially conservative commentators. There may be something to this, but we've got to be careful. And in particular, we've got to distinguish between efficient causes and permissive causes. An efficient cause is something that directly produces something else. A permissive cause is something that changes the environment and makes something else possible. Is Rousseau a permissive cause of the French Revolution? Probably. Probably, the way he articulated it. Would someone else likely have articulated it? Rousseau's not the only person thinking these things. So there are other folks around. It's entirely possible that someone else might have come up with the same thing, but they probably wouldn't have articulated it in quite the same way or with quite the same degree of radicalism that Rousseau has. But I would say, yeah, Rousseau as a permissive cause of the French Revolution? Yes. Absolutely no problem there. Rousseau as an efficient cause? That's a much harder one to say. That's much harder. The efficient cause link between political theory and political revolutions that I think one can find is more likely to be John Locke and people in the American colonies, where people actually did read Locke, use that, make an argument based directly on Locke to say this is an unjust system of taxation that the king has implemented on the colonies, and therefore let's revolt against it. And even that's mediated a little bit by things like Thomas Paine. But it's much closer. Rousseau is a little harder. It's really hard to say here is someone who read Rousseau and therefore made a set of decisions about going to behead the king. So it's a lot harder to draw that kind of efficient causal line. Does it contribute to it? Certainly. Certainly. Right? Main currents of thought, the way in which Rousseau's Rousseau's articulation of liberal principles kind of tweaks it in a slightly different direction, or radicalizes it in a particular way that neither Hobbes nor Locke had done. Yes, I think that certainly is a contributing factor, but I'd be very, very hesitant about saying there's an efficient cause. It's always very hard to say that any writer or any set of ideas is an efficient cause of a particular outcome. There's usually so many other things intervening. So, I always get amazed at that particular argument. But since we're dealing with Rousseau, I thought it was probably worth mentioning a little bit. Another point that I want to bring up here, this is a slightly tangential, but I think it's useful with fleshing out some of the things that go on in Rousseau, is the connection between Rousseau and not the French Revolution, but the American Revolution. And the American Revolution is usually taken to be Locke's show entirely. All right, the American Revolution, the American Constitution, American political culture, all taken to be drawn directly from John Locke. Now, this is not entirely unrevealing, as the edition of Locke that we read last time definitely sort of points out very clearly. There are textual parallels, things that are directly borrowed from Locke, articulations and styles of thought and pieces of argumentation that show up in the Declaration of Independence and other sorts of places. So this does reveal certain things, but it's also kind of incomplete. There are some elements of the American Revolution and of the American understanding of democracy which sound less like Locke and more like Rousseau, which is kind of interesting. And so if we want to talk about Rousseau being an efficient cause of a revolution, or Rousseau being a cause of a revolution, I wonder if we may have to look a little bit at some of the design features of the American system. So, just a quick list of some of the more unLockean aspects of the U.S. Constitution. The things that are in the design of political institutions of democracy, or Republican democracy in the United States, that really don't have a parallel in Locke. For instance, there is the way the U.S. Constitution starts out. We the people. It's a collective declaration. There isn't a collective declaration in Locke, right? It's all individuals rationally getting together. There's no we, really. There's a bunch of individuals choosing to make their lives a little bit more efficient by designing a government that's going to protect all their property collectively. But it's not a we that sits down to do this. It's a group of individuals. Something a little bit unLockean about that. A more direct unLockean thing in the U.S. design, and this is apparent in the early American political thought of James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and some of the other folks who were arguing about the U.S. Constitution, is the opposition to what they called factions, which is to say groups of the people who have a particular notion in mind that they're going to try to put over on everybody else, motivated by a partial interest of some sort. That language very, very closely parallels Rousseau's opposition to subordinate parts of the polity trying to seize or go against the general will. Now, if you're a pure Lockean, then a faction is just a group of people united by interest, and that's fine because governments are just a group of people united by interest. So the opposition to partiality is a little harder to fathom if you just try to read this through a pure Lockean lens. Also, as has been widely commented on in the last couple of hundred years, the U.S. Constitution is not a direct democracy. The U.S. political system has lots of barriers to direct popular will built in. In order to amend the Constitution, you need to have super majorities of various kinds, lots of states consenting, lots of people consenting, more than just a majority. In the initial design, the only part of the government that was directly elected by the people was the House of Representatives. Right? The states themselves chose the senators, and the president is still elected through this weird mechanism of the Electoral College. Weird from a Lockean perspective, but doesn't make any sense why you would have that kind of mediation or barrier between the popular will and the government. But if you're Rousseau, it makes perfect sense. Direct popular election is not necessarily the best way to ascertain the general will. So there's something a little bit odd about those aspects of things. The Supreme Court. There's no court in Locke. There are no courts. There's no court system. There are parallels to this in Rousseau's understanding of the social contract. When Rousseau talks about the various institutions that are supposed to keep the general will intact while the government is implementing it, right, there's a parallel there to something like a court system, which we don't really have in Locke at all, which may have something to do with the fact that in Locke, the law of nature is supposed to be available rationally to anybody who reads it, so you wouldn't need a court to interpret it for you. Indeed, there's something very unLockean about the Constitution itself, about the whole idea of a document that represents what we the people have to say, and that somehow we the people can say something, and then a whole bunch of people later can disagree with it, but we the people trumps them. The idea of judicial review, the idea that there's a constitution which sets things down and laws that are passed can actually be in conflict with the constitution, which in some sense represents the general will. There's some terminological differences between that and the way that Rousseau would articulate this, but I think there's definitely some Rousseauian parallels in terms of how the U.S. is put together, and in terms of how the U.S. thinks about democracy, which is very important in an era where it's been officially declared that U.S. foreign policy is about exporting democracy. It's interesting to see what kind of democracy the U.S. actually thinks it's exporting. But anyway, back to Rousseau and the text in particular. What does Rousseau do in this book, in The Social Contract? Well, he tells you right in the first page. Right, he wants to try to find a way to preserve perfect liberty. Not as much liberty as possible, right? Perfect liberty. How do you preserve perfect liberty under conditions of social existence? All right, we want to stay just as free as we were before, not we're going to make necessary sacrifices. This is a much more grandiose ambition in some ways than either Hobbes or Locke. Rousseau relies on historical examples. He uses them. But most of the argument is a reliance on reason rather than on history. It's not Machiavelli. This is not take a few examples and draw conclusions from them. Mostly it's about rationally putting together a whole series of elements and then using historical examples as illustrations. So the standard of truth is a little bit different here. He tries very hard to anticipate objections to his arguments, sometimes in the footnotes, sometimes when he puts in odd footnotes about how you shouldn't rush him and he does eventually clarify everything, but he can't do it all at once, so, you know, be quiet and let him get on with his work. He gets a little testy sometimes when he does this. On the other hand, he clearly understands that there is going to be some controversy about his work and about his arguments, and he tries to anticipate those reactions and tries to respond to them. So that's certainly something that he does much more than the last few folks that we've read. And he's also more sensitive to the role of things other than the state, to other kinds of social groups, to other kinds of institutions, other things that exist in what we would now call civil society, which is to say that part of social organization that is neither the state nor the economy. And he's very sensitive to that. In fact, he's more sensitive to the economy, even, than certainly Hobbes was, and even more so than Locke. So there's more things than the state in Rousseau's understanding of politics and Rousseau's understanding of what political order should look like. And that has some effect on how he actually ends up presenting his case. A few questions to ponder as you read your way through the text. The first, kind of the obvious one, is how do people remain free if the general will can force them to do things? Rousseau has that striking claim about the general will forcing people to be free, which is just the most interesting turn of phrase, I think, and it's something that we probably want to unpack a little bit. How can you be free if the general will can make you do stuff that you don't actually want to do? What kind of freedom does Rousseau have in mind here? I'm going to pose this one a little differently than I've posed it in the past. I'm not going to say, is there a difference between the general will and public opinion? I'm just going to lay it down. There is, in fact, a difference between the general will and public opinion. Like public opinion as we currently conceptualize it, or public opinion as we've been conceptualizing it for the last 150 years or so, that's different than the general will. And I think it's worth trying to figure out exactly what those differences are, because that will help to clarify Rousseau's argument about this particular issue. Now, since we are IR scholars and IR theorists, we should be thinking not just about individual states. Rousseau seems to stop his reflections at the level of the individual political community, but I don't know that there's any necessary reason why we have to stop there. And so something to think about. Can there be a global general will? Could there be a regional, you know, Europe-wide general will that would somehow transcend individual European states? Right, those are things that I think are worth pondering as we go through this. does the general will have to be limited by the constraints of a particular political community? And a final question. Rousseau makes a series of claims about how things ought to be. It's more idealized in some ways than the other liberals that we've read so far. Would a Rousseauian system actually work? Could you do this? Could you actually have a system founded on the general will working in this sort of way? I think it's an open question, but I think it's something that we probably want to ponder, particularly since, if I'm right, that the American conception of democracy actually has some very serious Rousseauian elements in it, and given that our foreign policy, the U.S.'s foreign policy now, is pretty much explicitly about exporting democracy, the question of whether or not it would work is, I think, of extreme relevance and is something that we should definitely spend a little bit of time pondering.